Lows overnight tonight will range from the single digits across southern Michigan to the mid-30s across southwestern Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon: cloudy and cold with a high of 35 and a north wind from 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, becoming partly cloudy with a low of 25 and a light east wind. Tomorrow, partly sunny and warmer, the high 45. The wind will be from the southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, the low 35 and the wind from the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Thursday, cloudy with a chance of rain in the morning. Rain is likely in the afternoon. Look for a high in the upper 40s. Thursday night, rain likely early, then rain or snow after midnight. The low will be in the low 30s. Friday, mostly cloudy and colder. There's a chance of rain or snow in the morning. The high in the upper 30s. And the outlook for Friday night through Monday, mostly cloudy with lows in the mid-20s and highs in the low 40s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the low 20s to the mid-30s. Most locations reporting cloudy skies. However, there was some sunshine in southern sections of the two states. At Chicago's O'Hare Airport, 25, Peoria 31, 32 at Mattoon, in Carbondale 36. South Bend 21, Lafayette 26 degrees, light snow reported there at the top of the hour. In Indianapolis 30 with light snow. Terre Haute 30, Evansville 37. Willard Airport reported cloudy skies at the top of the hour, the temperature 31. The dew point 26, the relative humidity 82%. The wind out of the west at 10, giving us a wind chill of 22. The barometric pressure 30.17 and steady. And at 12:39, 32 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois, the sky is cloudy. Generally speaking, consumer spending in the U.S. was flat in 2010. There was a notable exception, however: auto sales. New and used vehicle sales jumped 20% last year. Economists say the uptick is a sign that consumers may feel the worst of the recession is over. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
It doesn't take much to realize that the car sector of the economy is coming back. All you have to do is sit back, watch TV.
Without all-wheel drive, it's the end of the world. With Dodge all-wheel drive, it's just snow.
Who's your friend now? The all-new Super Duty.
Annie Schwartz is a talent agent in Hollywood. She focuses on getting her clients jobs in TV commercials. When the economy's down, so is her business.
Commercials are all about marketing and sales and about a product. So we're really at the mercy of what's going on in business.
Schwartz says at the end of 2010, she saw a change for the better.
There seemed to be a lot of dollars to actually do car commercials this year. And it didn't seem to be just one car like Toyota or, you know, the SUVs.
After a very long dry spell, Schwartz says recently she's been able to place her actor clients in a whole variety of car commercials. What's different with this recent uptick is that demand for family vehicles translates into opportunities for families of actors.
There's been a lot of families, actually real families, where they've actually said, please submit kids between the ages of 6 and 9, and if their parents are interested, tell them to come along to the audition.
Schwartz says car commercials are one of the few places she's been able to consistently cast her clients. What Schwartz sees happening in the advertising business reflects what's happening in showrooms. Barry Bosworth is an economist at the Brookings Institution. He says car sales are directly tied to how consumers feel about their employment outlook.
So the moment you think you got a problem with your job opportunities and you're losing jobs, autos just collapse.
During a recession, if your job is secure and the jobs of those around you aren't, you might not want to be seen as the insensitive jerk buying a new car. But
these cars wear out. And after a couple of years, you expect a big rebound just to return to normal. But in other areas of consumer spending, it didn't go down as much. It's not going to snap back as much.
Retail sales overall didn't snap back as much. Beer, wine, and liquor went up 2.6%, and clothing and grocery only went up by 1.5%. New and used vehicles saw their sales jump 20%. That's according to a survey of businesses done by SageWorks, a research firm. Brian Hamilton is an economist and SageWorks CEO.
I don't think one sector is going to drive us out of the recession or continue the expansion that we've seen recently in the last couple of quarters.
Annie Schwartz, the Hollywood agent, says with the exception of cars, she doesn't see TV advertising bouncing back soon. But she says one really good car commercial could feed an actor's family for a year. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Detroit.
This week, we're airing a three-part series from Transportation Nation about mass transit, race, and inequality. We begin in the 1950s and 60s when the interstate highway system was built. In most cities, when urban planners decided where to put the highway, they often chose the black section of town. Reporter Laura Yuen tells us the story of St. Paul, Minnesota, where the construction of the interstate is still felt today.
Before the highway tore through St. Paul, the Rondo neighborhood became the heart of the city's black community. By the 1950s, Rondo Avenue was a bustling commercial thoroughfare, chock-a-block with barbershops and drugstores. Streetcars rolled by, and waiters, Pullman porters, and domestic maids who belonged to the city's African-American social clubs practiced their Saturday night dance moves to Count Basie. Nathaniel Kalik grew up in Rondo in a house that his grandparents owned for about 15 years.
There was at least three or four grocery stores that we could walk to. Everybody in that area knew each other.
Kalik sports a white whiskery beard, and at 67 years old, he's among the last generation to remember Rondo. He was 13 in 1956 when crews were leveling houses on Rondo Avenue to make way for the planned Interstate 94. Kalik recently retired as president from the St. Paul NAACP. Today, the 70 or so Rondo businesses are gone, and so are about 650 homes. Kalik remembers a day when his grandfather was forced out.
There was cop cars everywhere, and when I walked into the house, these guys had axes and sledgehammers. They were knocking holes in the walls, breaking the windows, tearing up the plumbing, you know, just to make sure that he didn't try to move back in there. You know, I was crying because it looked like something bad really happened.
And that's when they started tearing out Rondo. A house then was everything to the black people.
Oralee Patterson also grew up in Rondo and now lives in the suburbs of St. Paul.
To own your own home after, you know, you couldn't vote, you weren't considered as a human being, and then to see what happened with the freeway and when they came through and gave them nickels and dimes for that property, they never gave those people what their houses were worth. Never!
And besides the values of people's homes, a vital sense of the community was lost. Most of the leveled businesses never set up shop again, and residents dispersed throughout the St. Paul area. Patterson is 70, with roller-curled hair and shimmery lipstick. She's a former political activist who chaired the St. Paul Human Rights Commission. The experience of seeing her community torn apart stirred the early beginnings of her activism.
I remember all the dust and the debris and the dirt from all of the digging.
And the freeway wasn't built for at least 10 years, so there was a big, muddy hole in the ground that stretched from Rice Street up to Lexington.
Marvin Anderson, another 70-year-old, was a teenager when the freeway ripped through his neighborhood.
Whenever it rained, it would be muddy and dirty, where you couldn't play, where every day you woke up, you saw this gigantic eyesore. It demoralizes a community.
Anderson is a retired attorney and law librarian for the state of Minnesota. About 20 years ago, Anderson co-founded a festival to remember the lost neighborhood. He spent years searching for evidence that the government purposely selected the site of the freeway for all the wrong reasons.
Well, this is the letter that we found back in 1993.
It's a letter to the editor of the St. Paul Pioneer Press, written nearly 30 years after the freeway was built. The writer worked for the city engineer and admitted that the government chose the route for I-94 because it was in the city's low-income black neighborhood.
For at least 10 years, we had been saying this, and we had never had any evidence to back us up.
Anderson pulls out the letter and reads it.
The freeway location as it is now built was a political decision and not an engineering one.
The letter says the state legislature wanted to remove, quote, the slums near the state capital to enhance the area.
And we always felt that this was the smoking gun that we had always lacked, and it justified our complaint that the freeway through Rondo was not the proper route for them to take, and by using that route, it destroyed Rondo, the essence of Rondo. It decapitated Rondo. It amputated our soul.
The highway building would often plunge through the poor black neighborhoods of cities because they were the path of least resistance.
Myron Orfield directs the Institute on Race and Poverty at the University of Minnesota.
If highway builders tried to build through white neighborhoods or middle-income neighborhoods, they would run against a huge mountain of opposition that would impede the project in lawsuits and protests and political power that the white community had and that the black community didn't have.
Orfield says urban planners were more mindful of serving the middle class and getting drivers to work fast by building highways right into the city center.
They wanted to secure mobility to the central business district to make sure that people could move quickly through the city and not have to wait at stoplights. And they had a budget that they had with a limited amount of dollars. And if you directed it toward neighborhoods where the property values were relatively low and or there was a relatively high share of abandonment, this was the way to go.
It's not that African Americans didn't protest. Orley Patterson remembers black and white activists objected to the freeway from a civil rights perspective. She says the activists marched to City Hall and on other days climbed down into the freeway trench as a form of protest. Patterson noticed one spry woman in particular rallying passersby.
Oh, she was just down there and she was had her bullhorn and she was telling everybody, they are down here trying to tear up our community. And she would shout out all of these things, you know, through the bullhorn and what have you. I thought, oh, geez, she's a troublemaker. You know, that's what I thought then.
Patterson followed in her footsteps, becoming a civil rights activist and community leader. But the Rondo neighborhood was forever changed, so much that some residents today still call Interstate 94 the scar on the ground. I'm Laura Ewan in St. Paul, Minnesota.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 22nd of February, 2011. George Washington's birthday, born Westmoreland County, Virginia, 1732. Our first president, whose favorite foods were mashed sweet potatoes.